Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 25th of May, these are our main stories. Tina Turner, the rock and roll singer who rose from poverty to become a superstar, has died at the age of 83. Ron DeSantis has launched his campaign to become the Republican candidate in next year's US presidential election. But can he beat Donald Trump for the nomination? The head of a Russian militia accused of carrying out attacks in the Belgorod region says his group coordinated its actions with Ukraine. Also in this podcast, a paralysed man is able to stand and walk again thanks to pioneering electronic brain implants.
It's been a long time goal for me to stand up and have a beer with my friends, and it took me 10 years to reach that point.
The American Grammy Award-winning singer Tina Turner, widely hailed as the Queen of Rock and Roll, has died. She was 83. Her publicist said she'd been suffering from a long illness. David Sillitoe looks back at her life.
The melody of that song was,
When I was a little girl, I had a bread dog, only dog.
And that, I chill now.
Now I love you just the way.
It was another feeling to sing to that.
Rock and roll is fun. It's full of energy. It's full of laughter. It's naughty.
And it gets stronger in every way.
Tina Turner and a 60s masterpiece. River Deep Mountain High is a song about soaring heights of emotion, a hard scrabble childhood. And everything about it has turned up to 11. Pretty much sums up the life the person Phil Spector chose to sing it. A woman who was born Anna Mae Bullock in a place called Nutbush, Tennessee.
They call it Nutbush. Oh, Nutbush. On a Nutbush city limit.
I started out a girl in cotton fields, picking strawberries, country girl, family that didn't own property, but we were always very clean, and we had a roof over our head, and we had seasonal clothes, and I had dreams. My dreams came true.
As a child, she felt unloved, unwanted by her own mother. She escaped by teaming up with Ike Turner. He controlled everything, even the rights to the name he gave her, Tina Turner.
You should have treated me right. You wouldn't have to cry.
I was terribly unhappy. Extremely unhappy, continuously, day in, day out. I was fairy tale-ish. I thought, you know, someone would ask you to marry and you'd wear the white dress, and this was my wedding. A piece of paper pushed across, we signed, and after that we went to a brothel and watched sex. The violence and how evil he was. It was every day, every moment.
By the late 70s, the Acid Queen and Tommy had had enough and left Ike. But the years had gone by and her pop career appeared to be in decline. But what changed everything was a group of British producers and songwriters. The album Private Dancer sold 20 million copies, and in 1988, aged 49, she was one of the biggest acts in the world.
Toured with the Rolling Stones, Rod Stewart, Lionel Richie. I have done a recording with a duet with David Bowie. I've done a movie with Mel Gibson in Mad Max Part 3. I've had, for the last few years in my life, wonderful times.
You don't have to worry if you got no money. The people on the river.
Tina Turner, from the cotton fields of Nutbush to Buddhist superstar living in Switzerland. It was a story with a happy ending.
Most of my hardships came while I was young and growing up. So that means that in the last days, when normally people suffer from old age and sicknesses, my happiness came. I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. I'm happier than I ever thought that life would become for me.
The voice of Tina Turner, who has died at the age of 83. David Sillitoe reporting. So, what's been the reaction in the United States to Tina Turner's death? Ben Thompson spoke to the BBC's Jessica Parker, who was in a television studio in Washington.
Well, obviously, this is huge breaking news here in the US as well. Many networks running those lines that we've had from her representatives, calling her the queen of rock and roll. Her life story really was quite remarkable. She came from a rural community in Tennessee, and then she sort of started her career having met Ike Turner, and then recreated herself, reinvented herself, despite successive struggles many, many times. And she had not just a disruptive, abusive relationship with Ike Turner, which we've been hearing about, but quite a disrupted childhood as well. So I think for a lot of people, while remembering her incredible music, and of course, how many artists can really claim that you might name the title of their song something like The Best, and people will be able to start just reciting the lyrics by heart? So she was incredible in that way in terms of her musical legacy. But the fact that she did have those struggles through an extremely long career, and despite the ups and the downs, and there certainly were ups and downs, to do that so many times, I think a lot of people now talking about her as a real inspiration, not just because of her music, but because of her life story as well and all the obstacles that she overcame.
And Jessica, while you're talking to us, we've had a statement from that building behind you, the White House, saying that the death of Tina Turner is incredibly sad news. They say it's a massive loss to the communities who loved her. It's difficult to get a sense of quite how much has changed during the career of Tina Turner. I'm looking at some of the accolades awarded to her, but also the first black artist, the first woman to be on the cover of Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone magazine ranking her among the 100 greatest artists of all time and the 100 greatest singers of all time. There are so many records and glass ceilings that she broke through, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've just been listening there. And the fact that the White House has so quickly issued a statement, of course, the building that you see behind me, that just shows you what an iconic figure she was here in the US. And I think because of all the things we've just been talking about, it's going to take a little while to unpick the enormity of her legacy. It's really interesting. I was just reading about her life. At one point, she originally set out to become a nurse and then ended up being this musical icon, musical legend, as you say, somebody who smashed glass ceilings through her career, despite a lot of difficulties. Of course, it was later that we learnt about the abusive relationship that she'd suffered with Ike Turner. And as well, I was reading about the fact that, you know, he was the one that actually changed her name. She was born Anna May Bullock, but he decided to change her name without even consulting her. But she kept that name. And whilst keeping that name, she actually went to forge a career all on her own, and of course become a household name in the US, but much further afield as well.
Jessica Parker in Washington on the life and legacy of Tina Turner. And staying in the US, but moving from music to politics, the Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has launched his campaign on Twitter to run for the White House in 2024. He's widely seen as the only candidate capable of defeating the former US President Donald Trump for the Republican Party's nomination. Mr. DeSantis filed papers with election officials on Wednesday and later formally announced his plans in an interview on the social media website.
I am running for President of the United States to lead our great American comeback. Look, we know our country's going in the wrong direction. We see it with our eyes and we feel it in our bones. Our southern borders collapse. Drugs are pouring into the country. Our cities are being hollowed out by spiking crime. The federal government's making it harder for the average family to make ends meet and to attain and maintain a middle-class lifestyle. And our president, Well, he lacks vigor, flounders in the face of our nation's challenges, and he takes his cues from the woke mob.
So, who is Ron DeSantis? Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
He's 44, and that's important because he's so much younger than President Biden or indeed the other serious contender for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump. He's got quite a different background. He's an Ivy League educated lawyer who also served in the military, but he doesn't really push that so much now, instead of selling himself more as a kind of anti-establishment and particularly anti-woke candidate. He's a two-term governor of Florida. He was re-elected in November, and his big policy platform is that he wants to make America more like Florida.
We fight the woke in the legislature. We fight the woke in the schools. We fight the woke in the corporations. We will never, ever surrender to the woke mob. Florida is where woke goes to die.
He has a supermajority in the Florida legislature, so he's been able to pass all sorts of laws, and that includes banning all discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity in schools. Some pretty strict laws about what teachers can talk about in terms of race relations and racial history in America as well. There's a ban on any gender-affirming care for children under 18. There's a law against trans people using the bathrooms that they might choose. He's made it easier to carry guns concealed without a permit. He's introduced a very strict abortion ban at 6 weeks of pregnancy. It's part of where he's wanting to position himself within the Republican Party as well. He will say, basically, that he can offer Trump-style policies, but without all the chaos and the drama that comes with Donald Trump. And at the same time, what he's able to say after his electoral success in November is that he's a winner. He won a huge landslide here in Florida, but the only problem with that is his poll ratings have been slipping quite dramatically since that high point in November, and he's now trailing Donald Trump really quite badly.
The problem with Ron DeSanctimonious is that he needs a personality transplant, and those are not yet available. Almost all congressmen and women that served with him and knew him well supported me.
It's fascinating because, of course, remember, these men are practically neighbors, both of them living in Florida. And Donald Trump thinks he made Ron DeSantis because in the 2020 governor's election, Ron DeSantis wasn't doing that well until Donald Trump came in and gave him his backing. And then he scraped to victory. So Donald Trump thinks he wouldn't be anywhere if it hadn't been for his help. So he is furious that what he sees as his protege has turned on him and is in challenging him for the Republican nomination. That's why some of his attacks are so bitter.
Sarah Smith. There have been outbreaks of violence in Sudan, where a week-long ceasefire is meant to be in place between rival military forces. Many of the clashes were in and around the capital, Khartoum. After a one-day lull in the fighting, the truce appears to be breaking down, and there are fears it will be impossible for much-needed humanitarian aid to be distributed. A fighter plane belonging to the military has crashed in Omdurman. It's not clear if it was shot down, but a video shows the aircraft on fire before it plunges to the earth. I heard more from our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
There have been clashes in and around the capital, Khartoum. There's definitely been a lot of fighting near a military base in Omdurman. There's been fighting on the streets there as well. Smoke rising over the city again, which we didn't see for the first sort of full day of the ceasefire. And also a military jet that belongs to the Sudanese army crashed in Omdurman. It's not clear if that was shot down. But it's quite clear that the ceasefire itself is, if not over, breaking down pretty fast. We're also hearing some pretty grim reports from the Darfur region, a town called Zalingay, where there are already severe shortages of food and medicine, and civil society groups there are warning of militias allied to the rapid support forces that have carried out a lot of attacks in recent days surrounding the city, which is incredibly difficult to get through to. Communication links have been cut off, but they're certainly worried about a significant increase in violence there carried out by groups allied to the rapid support forces.
Will Ross. A 40-year-old Dutch man who was paralysed in a cycling accident 12 years ago has been able to walk again thanks to electronic implants in his brain, which transmit his thoughts to his legs and feet via a second implant on his spine. The development, published in the journal Nature, is still at an experimental stage, but already it's changed the man's life, as our science correspondent Palab Ghosh has been finding out.
People who have a spinal injury are often unable to walk because the signals from the brain can't get to the leg muscles when the nerves in between have been damaged. But a Swiss team has short-circuited the injured area by placing two implants on a 40-year-old Dutch patient's brain, which transmit his thoughts to a third implant in his lower back. Hertien Oskam told me it's transformed his life.
Standing in the bar and having a beer, that's a new possibility for me now. Instead of sitting next to my friends on the standing table, I'm now joining, standing. People don't realize it, that it's been a long time goal for me to stand up and have a beer with my friends. And it took me 10 years to reach that point. The beer tastes very good at that point.
Hertien can only use a system for only an hour or so each day, because it's tiring and the equipment is bulky. The research is still at an experimental stage and it's several years away from being available in the clinic. But Professor Jocelyn Block of Lausanne University said that it was an important step forward.
He shows us that it's possible to do it. You know, it's not anymore science fiction, but it's reality. And it means that other people in the future will be able to get it too. For at this stage, it's a little bit early because, you know, it's the first technology and we had to do the proof of concept. But then the idea is to have the possibility to develop a device that is available for everybody.
The researchers believe they can make further progress in the years to come. In the meantime, Hertien can look forward to having a beer with his friends more often.
Palab Ghosh. Still to come.
The space industry is not a simple one. However, you know, there's usually one or two dominant factors when you see something like this.
The satellite launch company Virgin Orbit is to permanently cease operations.
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the 2011 disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant.
There is no greater threat we face at this time than the one unfolding in Fukushima Daiichi.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. The head of a Russian paramilitary group that's opposed to President Putin has said it carried out a recent cross-border raid from Ukraine in coordination with the Ukrainian military. Ukraine has consistently denied having anything to do with the incursion, which saw villages in the Russian region of Belgorod come under attack. One person was killed and several others injured. However, Denis Kapustin, who claims to be from the Russian Volunteer Corps, said his unit always consulted the Ukrainian armed forces about its operations.
Everything we do within the state borders of Ukraine, we obviously coordinate with Ukraine military, of course, because otherwise we would have been Russians with machine guns running around Ukraine in wartime, obviously. Everything we do, every decision we make, beyond the border, behind the state border, is our own decision, what we do.
The White House says it's looking into reports that US military vehicles were used in the assaults. And staying with the war in Ukraine, there was another outspoken intervention on Wednesday by the head of Russia's Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Using explicit images as well as bad language, the Russian oligarch criticized his country's military performance in Ukraine, including its top leaders. And he warned that Russia could now lose all the territory it had conquered. The comments came in an interview he gave for a social media site. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, has been looking at a transcript.
First of all, Yevgeny Prigozhin wanted to talk about Bakhmut. The battle for that city in the east of Ukraine is still going on, and we already knew that it had had perhaps the most casualties of any battle since Ukraine was invaded. Now, Yevgeny Prigozhin said 20,000 of his mercenaries had been killed, half of those convicts who'd been released from prison in return for joining his mercenary army. He claimed that they had, quote, destroyed 50,000 Ukrainians. Now, there's no evidence of that or confirmation, and indeed, it's hard to see how he would know what the numbers were on the Ukrainian side. But we do know that the losses have been horrific on both sides. Mr. Prigozhin also referred to Kherson, a city which Russia occupied and then withdrew. Now, Yevgeny Prigozhin is clearly furious about that. He used words which we certainly can't broadcast, and some very graphic imagery to suggest that Russian troops had lost their nerve in Kherson and fled. And he warned that Russia could now lose all of the territory it's taken since the invasion, and indeed all the territory that Russia captured in 2014, including Crimea. Now, I should say Yevgeny Prigozhin is given to very dramatic suggestions like this. Not everyone is going to believe him. What you can't fault, though, is his logic when he said in this interview that the whole invasion of Ukraine had, quote, backfired. His reasoning was, well, he said this was supposed to be about demilitarizing Ukraine, but the result of the invasion is that countries all over the world have given Ukraine huge amounts of military equipment and training. He estimates Ukraine now has 10 times as many tanks as before and that its armed forces are very well prepared.
I think that as of today, the Ukrainians are one of the strongest armies. They have high levels of organization, training and reconnaissance. They have various weaponry, and moreover, they work using every kind of system, Soviet, NATO, anything, all with success.
How is he getting away with this? Because it's supposed to be illegal, isn't it, in Russia, to say anything negative about the invasion of Ukraine. They still call it a military operation, don't they?
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is, yes, a country where any criticism of the government gets you arrested. First, I'd say, he's not exactly an easy man to arrest if you wanted to. I mean, I guess it's not like the Moscow constabulary could send a few of their officers round to him and say, you're under arrest, please come quietly to the station. I guess if you tried to arrest Mr. Prigozhin, you'd have a war on your hands. He's surrounded by tens of thousands of perhaps the most violent people in Russia. But I think there's something else going on. It is a standard feature of the dictator's playbook to have different factions in your entourage and play them off against each other, divide and rule, basically.
Paul Moss. Here in the UK, a drug addict has died in the first case seen in this country and possibly Europe, connected to a so-called zombie drug, xylazine. It first emerged in Puerto Rico around 20 years ago and has since been found in the US and in Canada. I asked our health reporter, Philippa Roxby, for more details.
It's a very powerful sedative which is used by vets for animals. It's not approved for human use at all. But somehow it's found its way into illicit drug supplies in the US primarily and bits of Canada in the last year or so, causing huge amounts of worry because overdoses linked to this drug seem to have increased massively.
How does it affect people?
It turns them into zombies. There have been headlines about this zombie drug. That's basically what it's called. It's not an opioid, but it's a tranquilizer, a sedative. And what happens is that drug dealers tend to dilute heroin with it, with xylazine and fentanyl, to make the heroin go further. And so if you're a drug user, you don't necessarily know you're taking it, but it's a very dangerous drug, even in small quantities, and can cause real problems. And one of the other horrible side effects is that it has a sort of flesh-eating properties. It causes skin lesions, ulcers, and they tend to rot. So it's not a pleasant drug at all.
And it emerged, didn't it, in Puerto Rico, but it's been found, what, mostly on the eastern seaboard of the US?
Mostly on the eastern seaboard of the US, but originally it came through South America. And now we think it has been identified in Europe as well.
So what are the authorities going to do? Because the scary thing is people don't know, as you were saying, that they're necessarily taking it.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think even when this drug was identified in a UK man today in a report, the UK authorities didn't actually have a code where they could allocate this man's death because xylazine wasn't even on their list. And so that shows just how sort of unprepared parts of the world are for the effects of this drug. I think what they want to do is communicate to drug users that this potentially could be contaminating other drugs such as heroin and cocaine, and communicate clearly that it's a very, very dangerous and very concerning drug.
And how worried are the health authorities that now it's appeared this 43-year-old man has died? Are they worried that it's going to emerge not only more in the UK, but also across Europe now?
That's the fear now. There's very little evidence because it's such early days. And the danger is that it may have been missed in other drug deaths and they didn't know it was there. It was only because a lab in the UK picked up a strange result in some of the tests on this dead man that they realised it was there. So it may have gone uncovered in other cases. But the point is, it's now present in the UK and it's now present in these illegal drug supplies and possibly in Europe as well. So it could be causing wider problems.
Philippa Roxby. The satellite launch company Virgin Orbit is to permanently cease operations. The California-based firm had already sold off its main assets for $36 million, equal to 1% of what the firm was worth in 2021. Virgin Orbit, which was founded by the British billionaire Richard Branson, aimed to provide quick and adaptable space launches for the growing small satellites market. But it suffered a disastrous setback earlier this year when an attempt to launch a rocket into space from an adapted Boeing 747 aircraft ended in failure. This was the moment the plane lifted off the runway.
Here we are, wheels off the ground. Godspeed, Launcher 1. Godspeed, Cosmic Girl.
The company said the rocket launched from the Boeing 747 was lost after failing to achieve the required altitude. The mission had been billed as a milestone for UK's space exploration, which would turn the country into a global player, from manufacturing satellites to building rockets and creating new spaceports. But after the incident, the company paused all operations in an apparent attempt to shore up its finances and laid off almost all its employees. But even earlier this month, Sir Richard Branson told the BBC that his aim to send rockets into space was still very much alive.
Space travel itself is incredibly important for this Earth. Communication between people has been transformed because of space travel and satellites up there. Monitoring things like the depredation of the rainforest or illegal fishing has been transformed by satellites up there. You can't and shouldn't stop progress.
But on Wednesday, Virgin Orbit confirmed it was shutting down, selling off its remaining assets and its California headquarters. So, what went wrong? Will Bain spoke to Sinead O'Sullivan, a space engineer who's worked at NASA and is also formerly a space economist at Harvard Business School.
The space industry is not a simple one. However, you know, there's usually one or two dominant factors when you see something like this. I think ultimately what happened with Virgin Orbit is that the launch vehicle and the launch kind of services industry as a whole is ultimately right now a loss-seeking one. It's not impossible, but it's very, very difficult for any one company to make this business profitable. And in fact, none of the startups, you know, some people will say, well, SpaceX is doing well and Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos's company is doing well. So what happened with Virgin Orbit? Ultimately, you know, while they might seem to be doing well, none of them so far are profitable. And I think Virgin Orbit kind of was the first, but the first of many companies, I think, in the space industry that have kind of gone to the public markets to try to raise external funding and haven't been able to do that.
And SpaceX that you mentioned there, Sinead, of course, Elon Musk's company. So we're talking about backers with extraordinarily the deepest of deep pockets in the world. Just before we move on to why it's been so difficult to make money, just explain as well, this isn't about passenger transport, is it? It's primarily about getting the satellites that we use for everything, phone signal, internet, GPS tracking, as Sir Richard was saying there, you know, things that we monitor for, that's how they would make money, right? By selling subscriptions to the information that these satellites could beam back to Earth again.
Exactly. So Virgin Orbit and SpaceX, for example, at the minute, are mostly carrying non-human transportation, non-human goods, which is satellites. And so they go to different places in the orbit. Virgin Orbit was launching satellites to low Earth orbit. Well, I think that they had large customer demand for that. It's very hard to make, you know, launch is expensive. It's very hard to make this profitable, especially when you have so many competitors such as SpaceX, and especially when Starship comes online, that can do much, much, much bigger deliveries for lower cost.
Space engineer Sinead O'Sullivan. And let's return to our main story, the death of the music legend Tina Turner. Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones said he was saddened by the news, calling her enormously talented. The Canadian singer Bryan Adams, who paired with her on the 1985 single It's Only Love, said the world just lost one hell of a powerhouse of a woman. Chris Rhodes toured with Tina Turner back in 1985, and Colin Patterson met him during an interval of the Tina Turner musical, which is currently on stage in London. So, what was she like?
I knew her very well. I toured in 1985 with the Private Dancer Tour, and we had a screen, just like you'd see the first rock and roll tour that had screens and traveled the world with it. And everybody wanted to see her legs. So they charged extra money. So it was the first time video was used in cooperation with the music.
What was she like to work with?
She's the hardest working person I've ever seen in my life. I mean, we would do five nights, 500 miles apart, on a bus, all around the United States, Europe, wherever. And they would even, Roger Davies, her manager, he would add shows. She would add shows and go, we do six nights. You know what I mean? We're like, no, we can't do another show. No, but if Tina can do it, we did it. She lives in a wonderful place in Switzerland, and I got to go to her house. Well, maybe 7-8 years ago, I was traveling Europe. I got to see her then, and that was wonderful. You know, she's a wonderful lady. I mean, so spiritual, and she just dances in your heart. You know, you just feel that rhythm and that pulse. And I've never seen anybody with the power of a microphone so close. I was right in the front stage, and she danced with these ramps, and I kind of fly a camera crane in the air. Like, you know, the first time they ever did that.
So you got this really unique view, getting to watch her night after night on this. Was that her first tour?
It would be these women that would be like 60 in wigs, you know what I mean? Just looking like Tina lookalikes, you know, every night. You'd go to town to town. It would be Nebraska, New Jersey, Tina lookalikes, Miami, you know, wherever we went.
What was she like on stage?
You know what? I've never seen a woman, especially in high heels. And I heard that she taught Mick Jagger
to dance.
Dance, yeah. And she'll dance forever in our heart, in my heart, your heart, every human being that will hears that voice, the power of her voice, was just unbelievable. So raw. And your private dancer, a dancer for money, do what you want me to do. I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money, and any old music will do.
And that was Chris Rhodes on Tina Turner, who of course you heard there, who has died at the age of 83. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, here's Jackie Leonard.
Some good news for anyone who wants a bit more positivity in their lives. The Happy Pod is going to be a regular thing, an upbeat little addition to the Global News podcast feed, featuring nothing but the uplifting, inspiring, or amusing. The first in the new series will be on June the 10th, and if you want to get involved, send us audio of the thing that brings you joy. The usual address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
Thanks, Jackie. This edition was mixed by Stuart Willey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
When your business travel is out of balance, you feel it. At National Car Rental, you're in control. Skip the counter, choose any car in the aisle, and manage your rental right from the app. So you can balance the boardroom with the not-so-board. Climb rocks after you rock your presentation. And mix work with leisure. Or leisure with work. Find the perfect balance with National Car Rental. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.